Some people have asked me to tell a little bit more about Rafael. I don't know how many of you may have heard earlier talks of mine, or tapes, or perhaps materials, and some of you may be following Hugh Nibley's articles in the Ensign. How many are you reading those series? There's 9 now in the Ensign on the Book of Enoch. Well, there's some material here I think will be of interest to you. And the reason why I think some people want me to mention this is because I think that the particular use of this knowledge in my family has given me some very fine children and helped my sons and my daughters and created a relationship for us that has been superb. I have had no sweat, no frustrations. I've had no problems with my children. Maybe this is the reason. Let me see if it might help you also in your lives. How many of you have ever heard of the angel Raphael? Raise your hands. He's not mentioned in the Old Testament. He's not mentioned in the New, as far as I know. He's not mentioned in the Book of Mormon. But he is mentioned in a rather peculiar passage in the Doctrine and Covenants in section 128. And we'll use that as sort of a guide in laying the foundation for what we want to talk about here. This section of the Doctrine and Covenants, by the way, is one of my great and favorite ones. It's in verse 21. But I'd like to use 2 verses and give you some insights, being this is the month of the restoration of the Aaronic priesthood and perhaps the Melchizedek as well. Again, what do we hear, writes the prophet Joseph Smith, a voice of the Lord in the wilderness of Fayette, Seneca County, declaring the 3 witnesses to bear record of the book. The voice of Michael on the banks of the Susquehanna, detecting the devil when he appeared as an angel of light. Now, Joseph Smith wrote this in here, but in the Book of Mormon it says the devil appeared as an angel of light to Adam and Eve. And then in the Book of Pergate Price, the adversary appears to Moses, and that's a revelation given to Joseph Smith. But where was there any confirmation that any such things might happen? Well, in the Book of Mormon there's also a statement that Moses is translated. We didn't have time to get into it in depth, but I have here a document which talks about the preexistence of Moses. It's been from fragments or taken from fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls and others now pieced together on the Testament of Moses, deals with the preexistence of Moses, his being foreordained and prepared in the Council of Heavens to be the mediator of God's covenant, and that he will be a prophet, and to be a prophet you must know God face to face. And then it goes on and talks about how he ascended the mountain. In the book, the Bible, he was buried upon Mount Nebo by the Lord. But in these texts now, confirming the Book of Mormon, as he goes upon the mountain, he weeps. The people follow him, they weep. As they near the top of the mountain, the adversary appears as an angel of light and wants him dead. This is reflected in the book of Jude in the New Testament. Michael appears to detect and thwart the adversary so he cannot destroy Moses, because Moses has another activity to perform. In this text it says his intercessory role is not to cease with his natural death. As he nears the mountain, he lays hands upon Joshua and gives him a garment and certain other activities a Mormon could understand. As he nears the top of the mountain, angels appear, he becomes translucent, the Lord appears and he's translated. Now we have the whole document. So here we also have confirmation of this episode of Michael and the adversary on the banks of the Susquehanna. What were they doing there anyway? What's that all about? Do you know there's new research going on? This episode apparently occurred somewhere between the 28th, 29th, and 30th of May. Joseph Smith and Oliver had gone up along the banks of the Susquehanna River to the northeast. And as they had gone about 30 miles away, a mob overtook them. They had gone up to make a visit to get some supplies, and then the mob were going to kill them. They were put into a little jail, and when the mob began to exert its influence and force greatly, the sheriff let them out the back window, and they climbed down on the banks of the Susquehanna River and tried to work all night back to Harmony, where they'd been translating the Book of Mormon. And it was early in the morning when finally Oliver fell over a tree and says, I can't go any further, I'm totally exhausted, and Joseph Smith tried to carry him. And then in the peak of his exhaustion, when he fell to the ground, the adversary appeared as an angel like to destroy him. And that's when Michael appeared, because Joseph Smith had not yet been instructed how to dispense the adversary in the name of Jesus Christ, which is a full description and describing how to use the name in another document found in Egypt. Then it's when Peter, James, and John appeared and gave them the Melchizedek priesthood. Here it says as it goes on, when detecting the devil, when he appeared as an angel of light, and the voice of Peter, James, and John in the wilderness between Harmony, Susquehanna County, and Colesville, Broome County, where they were taken by the mob, on the Susquehanna River, declaring themselves as possessing the keys of the kingdom and of the dispensation of the fullness of times. But we haven't got to Raphael yet, have we? Okay. And again, the voice of God in the chamber of old Father Whitmer in Fayette, Seneca County, and at sundry times, and in divers places through all the travels and tribulations of this church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the voice of Michael, the archangel, the head angel, and the voice of Gabriel. Documents have now been described by Hugh Nibley, and they've been taped, where Michael is described as Adam and Gabriel as Noah. And then in the hierarchy of angels, the third, and of Raphael, the voice of Michael, the archangel, the voice of Gabriel, and of Raphael, and of divers angels from Michael or Adam down to the present time, all declaring their dispensations, their rights, their keys, their honors, their majesty and glory, and the power of their priesthood. Well, who was Raphael? And what was all these got to do with him? Giving line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little, giving us consolation. That's the meaning of the word Raphael. By holding forth that which is to come, confirming our hope. The basic background and meaning and the activity of Raphael is right there. Well, in the commentary to the book, The Doctrine and Covenants, here, on page 810, it says, Raphael. From the Revelations, we know that Adam is Michael and Noah is Gabriel. John the Baptist is called an angel. So is Moroni. Who Raphael was in the flesh is not revealed in the apocryphal book called Tobit. Now, are we supposed to read Tobit? Can we count upon it somewhat? In the 91st section of Doctrine and Covenants, you have been commanded to read the Apocrypha. How many of you have read it? Because it is mostly translated correctly. But you must read with the Spirit, because there's been some additions by the hand of men. In the book of Tobit, he is represented as saying, I am Raphael, one of the seven holy angels which present the prayers of the saints and which go in and out before the glory of the Holy One. In the revelation of John, in the book of Revelations, there's also an interesting description of a great revelation given by John. He was actually taken in vision to the tabernacle of prayer, where the prayers and the testimony of the saints are actually printed and published, literally, I suppose, on a bulletin board type effect, so that the saints there, so that the predecessors, or even the relations of the individual, can enjoy your testimony or feel frightfully concerned about your welfare in the absence of a testimony from you. In the tabernacle of prayer. So if you haven't borne your testimony lately, better get one on the bulletin board up there. There's somebody up there that's quite concerned. And there's reasons to be. Raphael, in the documents then found among the Apocrypha, there's another document found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the material that Nibley was preparing, of which the first issue came out last fall, A Strange Thing in the Land, The Return of the Book of Enoch. Now, I'm not going to repeat to you what's in here, because some of the material in the last issue of the Ensign shows verbatim parallels that Joseph Smith could not have conjured up in his mind in 1830 when he received that vision concerning Enoch. But we'll go to material found in the same book of Enoch and some background material that refer back to Raphael. But before we do, I want to lay a little bit more foundation. Nibley talks about three books that have been found on Enoch. One was a book called the Sylvanic. One is the Ethiopic text, because it was found in Ethiopia. And one is called the Hebrew text, translated by Odberg. Those three books represent the basic background on the book of Enoch until the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Now, there has actually been a really, truly suppression of the publication of the material of the book of Enoch for 12 years. He discusses that in his works. Why? Because they confirm many tremendous things concerning priesthood, restoration, pre-existence, eternities, deity, and everything, and particularly, almost verbatim, material in the Purgate Christ. Now, in background, in the year 1773, after a period of almost total obscurity lasting 1,500 years, the Scottish explorer James Bruce discovered in what is now Ethiopia the Book of Enoch. He writes, amongst the articles I consigned to the library at Paris was a very beautiful and magnificent copy of the prophecies of Enoch. In large quarto. Another is amongst the books of scripture that I brought home, standing immediately before the book of Job. It was originally in the canon of the ancient scriptures, which is its proper place in the Abyssinian canon. And a third copy I presented to the Bodleian Library at Oxford by the hands of Dr. Douglas, the Bishop of Carlisle, 1873. This James Booth was really an explorer. He used to go all over the place. He found another book This was in Cairo, and he sent it home. Today it's being translated into English, and part of the problem of a Mormon translating into English is because it violates, if you got it fully in English, the details of the temple endowment and the activity of the veil. That book wasn't translated into parts of English until just the last decade or so. Now, the Book of Enoch rested there in the library at Oxford and was forgotten until 1821, when Dr. Lawrence issued his first translation, of which there were many editions, culminating in the revised edition of 1883. And this is a copy of 1883 that I have here. And then notes were compiled from his estate to complete it. As a former professor of Hebrew at Oxford, Lawrence's familiarity with the Jewish and the other sources give him a unique qualification that was especially useful in translating a work of this type. But Joseph Smith, by the time 1883 rolled around, had already been in print with his material since 1830, and he received his from a vision. Now, with that little bit of background as to the Book of Enoch and what has been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls 1945, and will appear in English this spring, hopefully. It cost $150 to get it. It's very expensive. Then we can ask ourselves a little bit, Raphael then, who and what was he? Part of the background of Raphael from the Jewish sources and from the Book of Tobit, we find that Tobias himself was encountered or had a confrontation with Raphael, and Raphael accompanied him on a trip into Babylon in the year 701 B.C. And on a certain occasion, he did not want to deceive Tobias, and they would not eat, because he says, I'm still a spirit, I've not been tabernacled in the flesh. A rather unique doctrine. And we also know from Joseph Smith's revelations that a spirit will not deceive you, a true spirit. He will not attempt to deceive you where the adversary will. And so Raphael revealed himself as a spirit, not yet tabernacle. So he wasn't a translated being, he wasn't a resurrected being. And we still don't know who he was, for sure, because most of the other prophets appeared to Joseph Smith. We have not been able to identify Raphael. But in the Book of Tobit, then, he acted in one of his special offices. He is a healer. He's in charge of the wounds and the sicknesses of men. That's one of his delegate authorities. Gabriel has his. He's an Elias, a forerunner. Like coming to Elizabeth and to Mary. Michael is in charge of priesthood, and so each of these have delegated authority and power. Raphael is in charge of the testimonies and prayers of men. He's in charge of the spirits of men. And in one of the episodes, you can reconstruct this event from the Book of Enoch. When you die, the Book of Mormon says that the angel will take you to the God who gave you life. What angel? Perhaps one of Raphael's or whoever. And he's going to ask you to tell him. You're going to say, tell him what? And he's going to say, don't you know it? And you're going to say, know what? He says, you don't have the name? And you're going to say, what name? He's also the tour guide to the other place. It's in the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants that says that the gods and angels are set there. And they're going to ask you things. And in the 131st section of Doctrine and Covenants, it says that if you have the new name, you get the white stone upon which is written the new name. And only those who have the new name get the stone and become exalted. So Raphael is going to be quite cognizant of your situation when you leave this sphere. And if you don't have the new name, I encourage you to get together with a good elder and make preparations and get it in the next year or so. You never can tell what will happen in the future, and your confrontation with Raphael may be real someday. Well, also Raphael, in another place, he is the guide to the underworld, as I mentioned. He is also one of the four presences set over all the diseases and the wounds of the children of men. Raphael is charged also to heal the earth, and through him the earth furnishes an abode for man, whom also he heals with from his maladies. Raphael, being in the third in the hierarchy of angels, is in charge of the earth's production. The fasting and prayers of the saints lately to get rain, I suppose Raphael may have some delegated authority in that area. He'll respond to our prayers to the degree we sanctify ourselves on the Sabbath day, as the prophet recently said in conference. In another place, we also find that Raphael was one of those who visited Abraham and was credited with the healing of Abraham during his period of circumcision when the great covenant was given. Raphael is the angel sent by God to cure Jacob of the injury to his thigh, is another story from the Jewish sources. Another one claims that it was Raphael who handed Noah after the flood the book. And in one of the Nag Hammadi books and one of the other scrolls, it talks about the books that were passed down by Seth to his descendants, then given to Noah, who took them into the ark, and then Noah passed them on to his sons after that. Among other high offices, Raphael is the regent of the sun, chief of the order of virtues. Now we start getting close to something he's going to be useful for in terms of your children. Chief of the order of virtues, governor of the different degrees of the south and the west. He's the guardian of the tree of life and held the flaming sword, according to one story. He's also one of the angels of repentance, of prayer, love, joy, and light. Above all, he is, as his name donates, the angel of healing. He is also the angel of science and knowledge and the preceptor angel. He belongs to at least four of the celestial orders in the terms of the great powers there. He's also numbered among the great holy ones, 10. And while he's not specifically named as the angel, they believe he was the angel who troubled the waters at the pool in ancient Bethsaida, mentioned in the New Testament. Curious enough, perhaps Raphael has been called a guide to hell. There's even a representation in some of the documents found in Egypt that he is also has a certain form. He's associated with the other angels, Michael and Gabriel. And then he's been painted by many others. Now, one of the things that he's done that an LDS person can understand is he gave the 5 points of fellowship, the Star of the Pentalpha, to Solomon in the Temple of Solomon. We could understand that. Non-Mormons may not. When Solomon prayed to God for help in the building of the temple, God answered with a gift of magic brought to the Hebrew king personally by Raphael. The gift of magic was the ring engraved with the 5-pointed star, the Pentalpha. Today you will find the Pentalpha on the Articles of Faith as we now take the Church
of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saint doctrines to the Jews. Moroni and the Pentalpha star on the Articles of Faith. Some of you may have seen them. I have
my copy that's being used in Southern California now. Well, that's a little bit of background on Raphael, but there's two things. He's in charge of the spirits of men, and then we find in another part of the Book of Enoch that he contends, and this is an important thing. He's the one who can contend with the destroyer. As a zeal, the destroyer of Lucifer can be bound up by chains by Raphael. Then there's Asmodeus, another destroyer of Lucifer, the adversary. He also can be bound by Raphael. Then among the 7 angels, the hierarchy of great angels, one is called Raguel. He is a destroyer also, and he has been let loose upon the earth since 1883, according to Wilford Woodruff, and much of his work begins with the saints. So Raphael is the one then who intervenes where the destroyer is concerned. Now the key is there. So I tell my sons, hey, read the Doctrine and Covenants, 89th section. They said, yeah, Dad, that's all about don't smoke and don't drink and things like that. I said, but you didn't read long enough. In the back it says, if you do these things, if you obey them, the destroyer will pass you by. And I said, and what does it say in the 5th of the 10 Commandments? And so they read it, and sure, it says, honor thy parents, and thy days will be long in the land. And I said, but Paul tells us something more in Ephesians, there in the 6th chapter. He says, the 5th commandment is the first one with promise. Now, if you read the 10 commandments, you'll find that's interesting. The 5th commandment, honor thy parents, and thy days will be long in the land, is one with promise. And then Paul tells us one other thing. If you will honor your parents, all will be well with you. What a great addition. I said, now never lie to me. Comes as a shock to him. Don't break the word of wisdom. If you're going to go on a date or something like that, be sure you tell me when you're going to be home and then be home. Point. One of their friends, a young LDS boy in one of their hometowns, lied to his mother, said he was going to a movie. Instead, he took a friend and on a bicycle they went to a city about 14 miles away. About the time the movie was supposed to be over, the boys came home. But on the way home, they were overtaken by a drunken driver and both killed. A LDS mother learns that her son is dead on a highway 14 miles away instead of sitting in a movie house around the block. If you lie to your parents and the destroyer overtakes you, you have no promise. Raguel will not intervene. My son called me at 10 o'clock at night. He is supposed to be home at 10 o'clock. It's 59 minutes to 10. He says, Dad, I'm going to be late tonight. And I said, son, I thank you for calling me. You just keep Raphael on duty. He says, that's what I had in mind. Maybe it wasn't quite words to that effect. But at any rate, he understood, and that's what it was about. We had grown to understand Raphael, and I'll explain to you on what basis. On the way home, however, he went to sleep and totally demolished his car. Insurance paid for the car, and he was not hurt. Just barely a thing on the back. I think to this day we both believe that Raphael intervened. Had he not honored me, had I been waiting there for an hour and a half for him to return that 90 miles or longer, who knows what might have happened. Well, we took all these books that I have here. We took the Book of Enoch. We took this material that I have here and some materials. And we were going to go on a deer hunt. It was Friday night. And we needed to be back by Saturday evening because we all had talks to give. At 6:30, we hoped, therefore, that because we weren't going to hunt on the Sabbath and we were going to try to do all the work, that we would be blessed with a harvest, because Nephi was a great hunter, and we believed that hunting should be an enterprise that all good prophets should engage in. What justification, anyway? But we took these books along so that when we had time, we would be able to understand and maybe study Enoch and also learn about Raphael. We were really trying to understand him, because they'd remembered the episode of their dead friend. Early in the morning, as we approached the one canyon, sure enough, there were some beautiful deer. But we couldn't hit them. I suppose the Lord provides the deer, but if you can't shoot the gun right, you can't hit them. However, on the other hand, my brother followed through, and he got one of the deer there. But meantime, we went around the hill and up on top. And my son and I got out and came down through one of the canyons. And then I ran into a beautiful deer. I took a dead aim shot and rested my gun down, and I couldn't miss, possibly miss. In 31 years of hunting, I had a dud bullet. Click, and that deer ran away. If I'd killed the deer, I'd been 1 hour later bringing him down out of the canyons. When we got up on top, my brother-in-law had shot a deer down, and when he walked over, it was gone. Apparently, he had blown off a horn, knocked the deer down, and then it got up and run away while he was going through the trees to get to it. Now, if he'd got that deer, it'd taken all of us half a day to get it off that hill. So I told him, drop me off here, and you run around the mountain and go down this canyon, and I'll walk around over the ridge, and maybe I'll see some deer. And just as they turned around and left, three beautiful bucks jumped up, and I knew I was going to get one of those because I could trap him in a little teeny canyon. I started running real fast, and I got a rock in my shoe. And I started kicking the back of my foot, you know, to get that rock to go forward. And it slowed me down a little bit, and it really hurt. And by the time I got to the ridge, I was slowed down so much there, the deer run into the trees, and I couldn't get them. And I took off my shoe and had a blister on the bottom of my foot. And I'm a geologist. I don't get blisters on the bottom of my foot. And there I had a blister, and it hurt. But if I'd got that deer, it might have taken several hours to get him out or to get over and get the boys back. So I finally went over a little bit despondent, and when I got down, the boy had turned the Jeep around and was moving up the canyon. It would make him a half hour late. Now, suddenly time becomes important here. But just as he turned around, another one of our friends who was hunting with us had come over the hill. He knew I was down below and got him to stop, and he turned around and come and got me. And when he stopped, the brake screeched, and my other son come off the hill, who hadn't seen anything. And we all got in the Jeep suddenly within a few moments. When we got to the upper pass, my brother had got his deer down, and others had done real well, so we decided we'd leave them and go on because we wanted to go into town and come on back for our speeches that night. But we had a couple of good places we could hunt on the way home. And we went zipping along, and we were talking about Raphael and everything, and we went right past the turnoff. And I don't know how we missed it. And then we realized we had not siphoned out any gas into the vehicle from the other truck, and we might run short of gas getting back into town. But we knew there was a gas station 21 miles out of town. We could fill up there. And we got so excited about Raphael and everything, we forgot to get the gas. And when we got to the top of this little one pass, we coasted 6 miles to get into town. And it took 0.9 gallons more gas than I've ever put into that gas tank to fill it up. We got out to the airport, and my son, who is a pilot, said, Dad, why don't you let me make a couple passes, because this is a high-altitude airport. And I said, Son, don't you think maybe we got a message here? And we all took stock of the situation. We said, yeah, we'd better get in the air and get back. We knew we had a good 2.5 hours. No problem. It's an hour and a half flight. We had a good 2.5 hours. We had plenty of time. But we began to surmise maybe something was in the air here. And as we got aloft at 10,500 feet, we ran into tremendous headwinds. And in central Nevada areas, there's no weather station there to really warn you what might be coming up, especially if you get a Nevada low. And so something was developing in the air, and it created a headwind so much that 2 hours later we're still in the air. Now it's getting dark. And we get over the air on the radio that there's a storm moving north of Las Vegas, covering one of the mountains we have to go over, which has peaks at 9,800 feet, and there's icing at 7,000 feet. Well, we're comfortable. We can descend through it, perhaps. We got the carburetor and everything. We can pull the heat and do all kinds of things. But as we near the top of the mountains, there's a break in the clouds on the right side. And so we can see the storm coming. It's terrible, and the wind is tremendous, and we drop down along the test site and come in right underneath those clouds and land on some very bad winds on the runway, and right behind us everything socks in. So we only had 15 minutes to spare. So we all told each other, listen, and see what happens at each of our talks for the next 2 days. Let's see if there was something we were supposed to do, something we were supposed to derive from all of this. And then on Monday, we assess everything. Nothing unusual had happened over the weekend. We'd given our talks, and there wasn't anything really special and unusual. When I went out to the airport on Tuesday to get ready to fly again, the storm was gone, and I checked my airplane out. I found that the carburetor cable on my carburetor had broken. Had I been 15 minutes later, come in from 10,000 feet to try to descend through the ice conditions of the cloud and pull the carburetor, I'd have had no heat, and my sons and I would have crashed in those mountains. There would have been no way for us to avoid it. We'd all been killed. We feel it was Rafael might have intervened on our behalf. I don't know what you might think. But then another instance, a year later, we were hunting again. This time it was a good member of the bishopric and my friend and my son who had converted another friend of his, who's now in Germany. We'd gone hunting again. And we had become sensitive. The great glory of this gospel is to become sensitive to the Spirit until you hear the audible impressions that guide and direct you in your lives. You should be praying so constantly in the mornings and the evenings. And if you will pray and enlarge your and lengthen your prayers and live the gospel and increase your performance and resist evil, the inspiration and guidance you can get sometimes can create in you a testimony that you'll know gloriously this gospel is true. When I'd missed several fine deer within 100 feet, and I'm not known to miss deer, we all assessed our situation, and it was early in the evening. We had about an hour of daylight left. We all felt a similar impression we should go someplace. So we got in the vehicle, and we started to go, waiting for the impressions. Those of you who have been missionaries, and I have worked in the mission field, we know what these impressions can mean and do for us sometimes. But then we'd get the impression too, oh, hey, here's a good place to hunt deer, but we would go to turn right, the Spirit would say, go left, and was strong. Oh, what an exciting thing it is to know that there's guidance like that. And as we moved left, then we'd get the impression to go up here and turn left. And then we got the singular impression, all of us near the same time, go faster. And we were bouncing down the road, just banging around in the vehicle, and we come around a curve about 20 minutes before sundown, and there was a car stuck in the creek there. And a young man had just stood up from prayer with a little tiny boy. And they had just concluded, after being stuck all day in the creek, that they were going to try to walk 45 miles through 8 or 9 inches of snow to home. And they were not equipped to go. But they had been on everything they possibly could. There was no help. Nobody had showed up. And so they had just determined that that's what they tried to do. They would have perished. We had arrived just in time to get them out. A few minutes later, they had gone. They had been gone. We had never known that they had even passed through that area or how soon. But you see, the fellow was a person I helped convert. He was in my own ward. He's one of the most committed individuals I've ever met. His home teaching's always done. His prayers are the most humble. He's the first to devote his time, to give his effort and his means. Never has to ask twice. Are there volunteers? His voice is right there before the echo is gone. In 70 square miles, I was sensitive enough to be there to help him. 15 minutes later, we got our deer just before sundown. And then a year ago in October, I got a phone call from my son from Jerusalem. He called me Collect. I said, this had better be good. He said, Dad, I got another thing to tell you about Rafael. And it's into Zion Square in the New Jerusalem. And they'd be there then around 10 o'clock or so. And then they were going to spend about an hour there and then come back, get on the buses and go to the Hebrew University, where they were going to have a tour of the Hebrew University in the upper areas of Jerusalem. So the next morning, they got up. Now, he had previously marked his map, and that map was marked with red ink, and all the way down what they were going to do, and he had worked out with another person who knew approximately the destination what they should do. But that morning when they got up, he could not find the markings on his map or even Zion Square on the map, and he became totally frustrated. And his wife broke in about that time and said she had never known him to have been so completely frustrated. And in sheer desperation, or whatever it was, he said they abandoned the whole project. They just couldn't find where to go. So they skipped that particular thing and went directly to the Hebrew University. And when they arrived there, they had to wait for some time for their guide to show up. About 10:30, they got word that there had been an accident in Jerusalem and that their original guide was not going to be around, and so there was going to be another one who would accompany them. It wasn't until later on they found out what had happened. Now, he went into a room and he brought out this map and he gave it to me. He said this was the exact map he had marked. And so he marked this map for me again, and he marked the squares and everything on here, and then up on one corner he marked the time. At 8 minutes past 10 o'clock, in New Jerusalem Square, a bomb had gone off and killed 70 people. If he had been there with 35 people and my son, some of them would have been killed. And so my son called me from Jerusalem and says, "Dad, I got something to tell you about Rafael again." Another episode might be of interest to you. These things may be recurrent in your own lives. My patriarchal blessing tells me to honor my parents, and my days will be long in the land, and to obey the word of wisdom specifically, and the destroyer will pass me by. That's why I've gone into these scriptures that close and looked into the thing of Raphael and got my children to look into these things in detail, because there was this specific thing. And so I've constantly tried to honor my parents and tried to obey the word of wisdom. And on an occasion, when as a geologist, I was in a high mountain area, I came zipping around a corner on a one-way road with a 1,400-foot drop-off on one side, and a vehicle coming in the opposite direction by a drunk driver hit me head-on. My head knocked out the front windshield, my body wrapped up the steering wheel, my right knee took in the dashboard, and my left knee took out the door on the one side, and the engine come up partly into the seat. And the next moment, I was standing beside the vehicle with a scratch on my right shin. I've been in mine cave-ins that I should have been crushed to death, and I was only bruised. And then I should have been technically dead at 8:10 on February the 3rd this year. That episode perhaps might give you a little more information on what happens in people's lives. I never go any place unless the Spirit informs me to. Like last night, I was going to fly my own airplane down today, and last night the Spirit says, "Forget it. Get a commercial airline." And when the Spirit says something, I do it. I left Monterey, California, for example. 1,200 foot of ceiling, raining. And the Spirit says, "Go." Now, under ordinary circumstances, a pilot would have stayed on the ground. I had to be back for a certain meeting anyway, and I'd given a talk the night before. And so I did. I flew out, and I got into the air, and I got trapped between two layers of clouds. Had to backtrack and almost lost visibility in one segment of time. I never file an instrument flight plan. If I can't see the ground, I don't go, unless the Spirit says fly. And I got over Bakersfield, and I was flying along real nice, and I lost total visibility, and I got as low as I could, and finally the mountains were too high over Tehachapi Pass, and I had to turn around. And as I turned around, the Spirit says, "Climb 8,000 feet and turn around and go instruments across that pass." So I turned around, and I got to 8,000 feet, and it says, "Go higher." And I got to 8,500 feet, and it's raining now. All my windshield is totally covered with rain, and in one split second it iced. I had hit rime ice, and it totally solidified right there in my face. And I looked down, and my wheel began to get rime ice, just growing. And the whole leading edge of my airplane was totally building up, and I knew that in a few seconds my motor would all ice up, the cowling, everything, and I would go down like lead. And so I pulled the carburetor heat, and the Spirit says, "I got you this far." I was already beginning to doubt, you know. I started saying, "Boy, you got me into this." He says, the real feeling was, "Don't worry, pull back on your stick. Here I am with rime ice, and I'm going up into the air, and I got everything solidified, and my carburetor just about ready to choke out, and everything's about ready to call it quits." And the Spirit says, "Pull back on your thing," and I pulled back, and I went right out of the clouds into sunshine. The ice melted right off, and I flew over the rest of the clouds in the Mojave Desert and went home. Well, on 8:10 on February the 2nd, the Spirit says, "Keep on going." I had come in clear weather, clear to Nephi, Utah. And when I reached Nephi, the clouds had built up. The weather report had said good weather, but it had built up within a matter of a half an hour while I was flying. And when I hit Nephi, the clouds were down to 300 feet off the ground. And I had to descend from 10,000 feet to get under the clouds. And as I began to approach Springville, I knew I could catch the edge of the lake there at Provo and fly around the edge of the lake and catch the airport, because it's right on the edge of the lake. So my friend and I, as we flew around the lake watching the trees and everything, we were about 300 feet off the ground. Suddenly we hit total fog. You've been, you and I have driven in Nevada or Utah, but it's total fog. We had a whiteout. And we lost total visibility and everything. And the next moment, I hear a bump on my right wheel. I'm flying along, and I hear a bump, and I feel another bump, and a third one, and I've made a perfect landing on the ice, the lake. And I look out, and I can just barely see the track of my wheel in the fog. And I come to a stop. I know there's breaks in the ice and open water. And I didn't know where there's any smooth ice that I could land going, flying along and land. And so I turn around and I can see my tracks and I put the flaps on and everything and get my distance all adjusted and I take right off on my track and fly right into that fog and flew instruments back about another 10 miles until I come out of the fog and on the edge of the lake again. Then we landed at Springville. Then when I got home, my brother says, "What happened to you Tuesday morning?" And I said, "Why?" And he says, "I was in the field and I got a terrible pain at about 10 minutes to 8. He says, "I called my wife. She was all right. He says, "I called around." He says, "Do something. It happened to you." Between me and my brother and my mother, we have peculiar feelings about the conditions of each other. He knew something had happened to me. And then I got a letter back from my mother. She said, "I had a horrible feeling something was happening to you approximately that time when I told her what had happened." She said, "But I knew you honored me. All would be well with you." I'm on borrowed time. Whatever the Lord permits me to do, I'll try to do. Consecrate my life, my time, my effort. I know absolutely this gospel is true. I can confirm every unique doctrine, teaching, organizational practice from all these documents. Take hours to do it, but it's there. I prepared a 7-foot chart of the planet gospel in Japan. 7-foot chart from pre-existence, intelligence to 3 degrees of glory, and I could not confirm one item in a non-Mormon source. Today I can talk for 12 hours from intelligence to the 3 degrees of glory and everything in between and not use one Mormon book. That's what's being confirmed. Now I mentioned to you as I've gone along that this has been useful in my family. By teaching my children to honor their parents, instructing them in the role of angels, when we talk about the Aaronic priesthood being the key of the ministering of angels, we really don't know really what we're talking about sometimes. But when we realize the intervention massive that is available to men and young women who will honor their parents with assurance their days will be long in the land and all will be well with them. And so my children are instructed constantly, keep Raphael on duty, have him intervene and bind the chains of Azazel and Asmodeus the destroyer, and Raguel. And my children have so done that. They have so lived that their lives have been commensurate with that. I don't like to maybe brag about my children, but on the other hand, maybe I do. My children, because of that, have felt spiritually uplifted. In their younger youth, I try to tell them, my sons and my daughters, if I really knew who you were, I might kneel. Privileged that I am to bear you and bring you here in the life, to get you to maturity. I don't know who you really are, but I don't remember all the details, but their patriarchal blessings would confirm, and how marvelous that is as a guide, that prophetic, powerful thing and instrument to guide you in your lives. And so as I told them to grow in dignity and in service and to love God and grow in knowledge, they finally realized as they studied that the Holy Spirit could be a source of knowledge to them. And my sons, I challenged them, prove the Spirit. See if he will not do certain things for you. And I suppose that they decided, well, we'll see if Dad's off his rocker. We will really take the challenge. I have a son that will graduate from Stanford this summer. He's 23 years old with a doctorate degree. He got his degree in mathematics, chemistry, and physics in 19 months and 20 days, his bachelor's degree, using the Holy Ghost as a guide. His letters are constantly filled with inspiration. The Holy Ghost provides him and directs him. My other son tried to outdo him. He was challenged by his older brother. When my son was 18 years old, we petitioned to the brethren that he go on a mission. We wanted him to go on a mission because he had completed his entire pre-med with nearly straight A's, and they wouldn't let him go. So he went another year. Now as a senior in college, he's still too young to go on a mission. We petitioned again. He's only 18 years and 9 months, and he's still going to go on a mission. During that last year, he had taught school, earned some money. He actually taught chemistry in the community college while he was doing his own work. And so he decided he'd go to Israel and study for 6 months. to get old enough to go on a mission. When he was in Israel, he called and he said, "Dad, I have a feeling they're going to call me on a mission." And he wanted the bishop's waiver and the state president's waiver so that he could be interviewed by the branch president in Jerusalem, and all of these things made available so that he could be able to receive some kind of situation. And half of the stuff we sent to him never got to him. Then he was examined by a doctor, Jewish doctor, in Israel. He found he had a kidney infection, and the doctor wondered why he wasn't dead. And after 2 weeks, they finally surmised that that was just a common condition with him, and he was perfectly all right. So he was fine. Then in October, Howard Hunter of the Council of 12, chairman of the missionary committee, called my son on a mission. In November, my son is still in Jerusalem, I get the mission call. I call my son up. I said, "You're going on a mission." He said, "I know." I said, you know where you're going?" Because I figured, oh, I better not tell him. He probably already knows. And he said, "Yes, I know where I'm going." He was going to Iceland. They had just opened up the Iceland mission a few months earlier. And Howard Hunter had been inspired to call my son to Iceland. The last missionaries in Iceland were my great-grandfather and his son. They were the last ones to confirm a member of the church in 1914, when they closed down the Iceland mission because of World War I. And the mission had been laying dormant for 62 years. And now my son was being called on a mission. He wasn't supposed to go when he was 18. He wasn't supposed to go when he was 18 years and 9 months. He was supposed to go when the Icelandic mission was opened up. And he was the first one to confirm a person into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the Icelandic language since my great-grandfather. We believe the gospel is true. I woke my son up one night. I said, "Son, listen to this." I was reading a document, and they liked some of these things. And I said, "The firstborn was the law that engendered all. Next to the firstborn was outpoured chaos. Thirdly, the soul received a law as it worked. Hence, clad in animal skins, the soul labors, captive as a spoil for death. Now with royal honor it sees the light. Now cast on into misery it weeps. Now it is wept for, it rejoices. Now it weeps, it is judged. Now it is judged, it dies. And without escape, the wretched soul enters a labyrinth of evils in its wanderings." And about that time, he wanted to go back to sleep. I said, "But listen, Ty, listen to this one. But Jesus said, 'Father, behold, pursued by evils here upon the earth, there roams the work of thine own breath. It seeks to escape the bitter adversary, chaos. It knows not how it shall win through. Therefore, send me, Father. Bearing the seals, I will descend. I will pass through all the ways. I will disclose all the ordinances. I will show the forms of the gods and the hidden things of the holy way. And awakening knowledge I will impart.'" And those words are only found in the 4th chapter of Moses, a vision given to Joseph Smith, and the 3rd chapter of Abraham, translated by Joseph Smith from the Abrahamic record. Then over on the next few pages, I mentioned to you I'd give you some information on the Heavenly Mother. So let me get that material, and I think that will be of interest to you. The doctrine of a Heavenly Mother. How unique it is that this church should happen to teach that particular thing. Marriage is the grandest and most glorious and most exalting principle connected with the gospel. In fact, the crowning gospel ordinance requisite for godhood is celestial marriage. The law of celestial marriage contained in the 132nd Doctrine and Covenants is called a temple marriage today. It is the basis for that. Now, these documents that I'm reading from are the Nag Hammadi. They come from the Egyptian material. And some of the predecessor material will show you how these discoveries confirm our Mormon doctrine. The word of the Lord that came to Joseph Smith, declaring that it is impossible for men and women to attain the highest glory in the celestial kingdom except they obey the law of celestial marriage and keep all the commandments. And what he declared was this: in the celestial glory there are three heavens, and in order to obtain the highest, a man must enter into this order of the priesthood, meaning the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. Now, if we found an ancient document that said the same thing, wouldn't that startle you a little bit? And that's what we have. That's what we found. Later, the prophet explained that the revelation meant by the statement that they shall be gods, that they shall bear seed. He pointed out that the gods were to be parents of spirit children, just as our Heavenly Mother and Heavenly Father were the parents of the people of this earth. And then he introduced, you see, the doctrine of our Heavenly Mother. And so we see, therefore, that celestial marriage is the crowning gospel ordinance, and the home, the basic institution. Now, if we found in these ancient documents in the first and second century that there was parental relationship and a mother and a doctrine of a mother in heaven, how startling that would be in confirmation. Thus, if properly lived, the covenant of marriage becomes the means of the greatest happiness, satisfaction, power, and perfect love in the world to come. If men and women have obeyed this holy ordinance and all the other principles of the gospel, then shall they be gods. And if we could find a document that would confirm that, how spectacular it would be in our sacred doctrines. And we did, and I'll read to you them in a moment. In the patriarchal blessings of faithful women, the inspired promise is sometimes found that they shall be mothers in Israel. This expression has reference to either or both the following states. You may be a mother in the house of Israel here in mortality, or you may be a mother among exalted beings in eternity, or both, among those for whom the family unit continues. Those who shall rule and reign forever in the house of Israel, motherhood in this life brings forth mortal offspring. In eternity, it will bring forth spirit children. That's expectation. And then this is a formal pronouncement and enunciation of the doctrine of the Heavenly Mother by the First Presidency. Some of you may not even know it exists. Implicit in the Christian truth's verity, all men are spirit children of the God, the Eternal Father, is the usual and spoken truth that they are also the offspring of an Eternal Mother, an exalted and glorified man of holiness. And there again, if we could find in the ancient documents that Father is called man, we would also confirm this. An exalted and glorified man of holiness could not be a father unless a woman of like glory, perfection, and holiness was associated with him as a mother. The begetting of children makes a man a father, and a woman a mother, whether we are dealing with men in this mortal or immortal state. This doctrine that there is a mother in heaven was affirmed in plainness by the First Presidency of the Church, Joseph F. Smith, John R. Winder, and Anthony H. Lund. When, in speaking of preexistence and the origin of man, they said that man as a spirit was begotten and born of heavenly parents and reared to maturity in the eternal mansions of the Father, that man is the offspring of celestial parentage. Now, these words I emphasize, listen carefully, because I'm going to read them from an ancient document. And that all men and women are in the similitude of the universal father and mother and are literally the sons and daughters of deity. This glorious truth of celestial parentage, including specifically both a father and a mother, is heralded forth by the song we sing, O My Father. Now let's go to the documents. There's one other, perhaps here Milton R. Hunter brought out, the ancient prophets, Enoch and Abraham, both were privileged to see and vision the spirit world. So was Joseph Smith, predicted in 76, section of Doctrine and Covenants. And there they beheld the sons and daughters of God, the Eternal Father, and the Eternal Mother. In the 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, it states that when Lucifer fell, the heavens wept. Who wept? Mother wept. And in one of these ancient documents, I'll read to you what happened. The significant point in the whole statement is that they beheld the spirits that God had created, and in the vision of Enoch, the book of Enoch again, they beheld things that were not visible to the natural eye. Now, God the Eternal Father proposed the plan of salvation. Where was there ever such a doctrine? Is that a restoration? From another document, we'll actually read the proposal and your approval of it. That same plan which had been used in other worlds. Jehovah, Michael, Gabriel, and other faithful men and women championed this plan, and all the spirit children of our eternal parents had their free agency to choose the Father's plan or the one proposed by Lucifer. So the devil rose up in rebellion against God and was cast down, and all who put up their heads for him. And we'll read you that from a document in a moment or two. So let's see. I think we get to the documents here now. I'm going to go to the longest of all the Nag Hammadi texts. It's only an excerpt here. The full translation has not become available. This excerpt is only a couple years old by Dr. Gibbon of New York. He knows nothing about Mormonism. Now listen. It begins in the spiritual world, the realm of the Supreme God and the Mother. The speaker, to be identified later with Jesus Christ, asserts that he originates from this celestial region and that he is the revealer and brings forth the word. The speaker calls together the heavenly church and presents the plan. He is to come forth to reveal the glory to those on earth who are kin to the celestial beings. And the heavenly church then gives its approval to the plan. I could use that in a conference report. I wouldn't have to change one word. pure and simple Mormon doctrine confirming those ancient things. Well, there's even a better one than that in certain respects. This one comes from Dr. Grant, who's worked on the Nag Hammadi also. He says, the ancients, therefore, the people of the text of Nag Hammadi, know that they were originally spiritual beings who had come to live in souls and bodies. They once dwelt in the spiritual world above and have been made to fall into this world of sense and sin. Now, thanks to their self-knowledge, they are hastening back above, having been redeemed from this world below. We were born into it, but now we're reborn into the spiritual world. And in that Nag Hammadi text, the great Seth, it states here concerning Christ. He said, let us gather a church. Willingly did I come forth to reveal the glory to who? My kindred and my fellow spirits. And by descent, by taking on an earthly body. And then in this text, there's the whole plan of the adversary to crucify him. And there's an instance where, having disturbed them and frightened the whole multitude of the angels and the ruler, there came about a disturbance and a battle among the angels. Now, whoever knew about those kind of things? He goes on, and in another place, the revelation of the Father, in another document, aims to give rest. Jesus brings men back to the Father. This is a recurring statement, and the additional phrase, unto the mother, is puzzling. Because see, no one knows about the doctrine of a mother in heaven. It's been our privilege to have had that all these times, and now these things are so interesting in confirming it. In another one, it talks about the knowledge of the Father and the virtue of the mother who brought forth from her bosom the Son. The Father brought forth from his bosom in silence and providence, the Father and the Mother and the Son. The prologue in another document states that men are without knowledge. They departed from their place in the Father. They were made to forget the doctrine of forgetfulness, their high origin in the Father, and we became slave of error. We mentioned forgetfulness, and because the soul, being immortal, can remember all that it knew prior to its birth in the life that it now lives. And finally, it means that at the end, in the ideal state, in the Father's place, we enter upon the meaning of true existence in the Father, which once we possessed without knowing it. And Dr. Hemhold had compiled from 9 documents the fact that we ascend to the Father and the Mother, from whence we came down to this world. And then in another document, it mentions again the Father and the Mother and the Son. The Father and the Mother and the Son collectively, and speaks again of the Son as the offspring of the Mother. The Son is described in terms of his origin. He is called the Son of the Father and the Mother, which recalls the use of both attributes, although they are distributed between 2 divine beings. The Mother and the Father are divine. It talks about the place where the creation takes place. It's called the heavenly world, a celestial region. There's an absolute rule in the heavenly world, can be seen by the creation of the world. And the ruler of this world is called Sakla, or the adversary. He is a son of that Father. And then I mentioned to you, there came a moment in the life of Mother when she wept. When Mother knew that the abortion of darkness was imperfect, since her consort had not agreed with her, apparently she'd put up a little struggle about Lucifer, she repented and grieved exceedingly. 76 second document, she went and wept. The heavens wept. And then in another document it says the brothers found their mother and they blessed her. They petitioned on her behalf. But the power on high prevailed over the one they call the mother. For they think that there are mothers in the higher world, females and males. They almost talk, says this translator, of family relations and paternal authorities. Every bit of our doctrine totally confirmed. And then this last one. There's no name for mother. My daughters give this talk on the Heavenly Mother, and someone had to ask her, what is her name? In this particular area, it says that the meaning of her name is goddess. She was the creator. The most basic in her general character is she is the mother of the holy, incorruptible ones. And when my daughter answered the question why we don't know her name, she simply said, we have so abused fathers, he's not about to let us know mothers. May you so honor your father and your mother that your days will be long in the land and long in exaltation in eternity. In Christ's name, amen.